Welcome to NPD Soundbites from ANPD, the Association for Nursing Professional Development. This is the NPD Forecast. Your hosts, Jen Bodine and Jillian Russell, are nursing professional development specialists with years of dynamic NPD experience. Jen and Jill round out ANPD's Nursing Professional Development Practice Team and are your personal environmental scanning forecasters. This podcast series features topics that are relevant to the forecasting of future trends for NPD practice and discusses implications that you can apply to your daily practice.
ANPD is on a mission to advance the specialty practice of nursing professional development. And these days, we're finding innovative ways to deliver valuable education and opportunities to connect. This August, log on and join NPD team members from across the country for Aspire to Inclusivity, the online ANPD annual convention. Taking place August 3rd through 6th on a robust online event platform, this year's convention program delivers 4 days of premier education and the opportunity to earn more nursing continuing professional development contact hours than ever before. Connect with attendees and exhibitors live and access both live streaming sessions and recordings you can view at your own convenience. This flexible online event allows your entire NPD team to enjoy the benefits of continuing professional development. Register now to join the ANPD community at Aspire to Inclusivity. Early registration rates end July 2nd. Learn more at www.ampd.org/convention.
Welcome everyone to the NPD Forecast. I'm Jillian Russell.
And I'm Jen Bodine. Today we're going to explore health disparities of the lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, queer population, LGBTQ. Today's conversation expands on a recent webinar that our guest presented entitled Considerations for Caring for Transgender Patients. This session established common language around gender minority patients, touched on health disparities, and offered participants best practices to promote an inclusive environment for transgender patients. We'd like to expand on some of these elements today and discuss NPD implications and strategies. With that said, we'd like to welcome Delray Zimmerman and Kelly Halski. Delray is the director of the Office for Diversity Affairs and LGBTQ Health at Vanderbilt University Medical Center in Nashville, Tennessee. In 2019, he was the recipient of the organization's top staff accolade, the Five Pillar Leader Award. He regularly facilitates training on the topics of LGBTQ healthcare and unconscious bias, and served on a team that launched 2 transgender health clinics in 2018. He has more than 20 years experience in nonprofit management, including volunteer leadership with Bliss in Tennessee and Out Central Cultural Center. Kelly Halski is the CEO and founder of Kelly Renee Life Coach LLC. She also chairs the Vanderbilt Program LGBTQ Health Community Advisory Board. As a visionary operations leader in the client experience space, Kelly is known for being a highly effective professional with a proven history of success in operations and the boardroom. Kelly lives in the Nashville area with her wife, Patty, and 3 dogs, Bentley, Sassy, and Eddie. Thank you so much for joining us today, Delray and Kelly. We're so excited to have this conversation with you.
Thank you, Jen and Jillian. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
Yes, we're very excited. Thanks. Thanks so much for having us.
Of course. So Kelly and Delray, as you know, Jen and I are both nurses, and our NPD community is comprised primarily of registered nurses. As part of our obligation that's noted in Provision 8 of the Code of Ethics for Nurses, we have an obligation to reduce disparities in healthcare. A 2018 position statement from ANA entitled "The Nurse's Role in Addressing Discrimination, Protecting and Promoting Inclusive Strategies in Practice Settings, Policy, and Advocacy" states, "All nurses must recognize the potential impact of unconscious bias and practices contributing to discrimination and actively seek opportunities to promote inclusion of all people in the provision of quality healthcare, while eradicating disparities. ANA supports policy initiatives directed towards abolishing all forms of discrimination. Health disparities are defined as preventable differences in the burden of disease, injury, violence, or opportunities to achieve optimal health that are experienced by socially disadvantaged populations. And that's a definition from the CDC. In 2016, the National Institute on Minority Health and Health Disparities formally designated sexual and gender minorities, which includes the LGBTQ population, as a health disparate population. First, I'd like to level set with some definitions. And Kelly, I'm hoping that you can help us define some of these. The first patient population that I'd like to define is that of the transgender patient population. How could you define that for us?
I think the simplest definition is to talk about someone who has a sense of themselves that's different from their biological sex.
The transgender patient would be someone who describes their gender identity differing from their sex assigned at birth.
Correct.
What other definitions would be ideal for us to level set for our listeners as we dive into conversation about health disparities for the LGBTQ population?
I think that's probably one of the biggest ones. The other one would be gender non-binary, in which case somebody may not necessarily align themselves with either sex, or may move from one to another, depending on their personal situation.
I think a couple other things to consider. I love language, and language has certainly emerged in this space. And so we also have a word, cisgender, and that describes someone whose sex assigned at birth aligns with their gender identity and sense of self. And I think it's a wonderful word to add because it provides a natural language complement to being transgender. And so in having that natural language complement, then it lessens the impact of othering someone. In medicine, we have a long history of pathologizing transgender people, which we no longer want to do. And because of that history, I think it is nice to create some equity in language. So we certainly want to add the word cisgender to the lexicon. And then we also want to consider the needs of intersex patients as well. And these are people who are born with both male and female characteristics at birth, including chromosomes, hormones, gonads, a variety of conditions could set up that would result in someone being intersex. And what's interesting here is that 1 in 1,500 babies born annually are actually born intersex. When I say that to a lot of people, folks find that really surprising. You know, being born intersex is as common as being redheaded, and yet not a lot of people are aware of that. And so in response to that, I often say, well, you know, that's because people who are dealing with these issues are also dealing with stigma. So it's not something that we talk about. But when we start to think that, wow, being born intersex is as common as being redheaded, then just from baseline, we establish that there is gender diversity in the world from a scientific perspective that goes beyond this binary of male and female, which is how the world has often operated. So anything that I can do to expand people's mind and thinking around the fact that there are more than two gender identities that exist, and that gender is actually a quality that lives on a spectrum, and that everybody has a unique gender identity, then when you start breaking it down, it makes it a little more palatable, easier for folks to understand.
Thank you so much for level setting with with some of those important definitions. And, you know, when I went to the literature and to find some statistics to shed light on, you know, how many individuals in the United States identify as transgender, for example, the most recent statistic I could find was from 2016. And there were 1.4 million adults identify as transgender. And with your comment, Del Rey, as far as the how common babies born intersex is, it is surprising to hear the commonality if you are not comfortable or familiar with how prevalent these health disparities for this particular population really truly are. Unfortunately, this patient population is disproportionately affected by limited healthcare access and poor health outcomes. And ultimately, at the end of the day, it's our goal to improve the quality of care. And that's really what's lacking. So how can we define what our role is to improve their access to care, to improve their quality of care? And it really starts with awareness. Even though, you know, some of this reality is incredibly disappointing, but knowing that there's a space for us to play a role. Del Rey, I wonder if do you mind sharing a story of health disparity in action?
Sure. I'll talk about a couple of different things, because I think, first of all, we have to look at health disparities on a systemic level. With our payer mix, the way we have our insurance system set up today, largely the world is still or at least in America, is still operating on, an employer-based system. Well, when you peel back a couple of layers of that onion, you realize that there is bias and discrimination that plays out in the employment sector, particularly around trans adults. And so we hear here at the medical center, we hear from patients day in and day out, and patients who are calling us largely because they've not been treated well in the past, and they're looking for a safe place who can help connect them to new resources. And so we provide that service here in the medical center. But we often hear from patients who lack these more traditional insurance resources. So we know that only one third of the LGBTQ community has traditional employment-based resources. And so for access alone can be highly problematic. Now, we work with a number of federally qualified health centers in the area. And so our job is really to connect people to care, whether it's at Vanderbilt or not. And so there are some resources that we can help point people to. But for someone who is looking for gender affirmation, who lacks insurance resources, and one of their goals might be gender affirming surgery, of some kind, then, you know, you start adding thousands of dollars into the mix and what somebody might be responsible for out of pocket. So that's one way, more broadly, how health disparities play out. And again, I'll speak a little bit more about bias and discrimination. I'll tell you a very specific story. A few months ago, I had a lesbian couple reach out to me, calling from outside of Cookeville, Tennessee, in a very rural area. One of the patients was also transgender. She was experiencing some facial pain over the course of several days, and they hadn't lived in the area long, hadn't established primary care. So after a little Google search, they found a provider to connect with. So showed up to the appointment, and as soon as the provider walked into the room, he threw up his hands and said, and found out that the patient was transgender. He threw up his hands and said, "I'm sorry, I'm not going to be able to see you today," and walked out of the room with no further explanation, not "see you later," not "good luck," nothing. Now, the couple, of course, that was a very embarrassing moment to them. So they picked up their belongings and left. Well, now the spouse, concerned, expressing concern, had the wherewithal to do a little further research and get connected to us. So we were able to expedite an appointment into ENT, thinking it might be a sinus issue. And so they had to drive 2.5 hours out of their way to access that appointment. Turns out the thinking from our ENT staff was it's maybe a neurological issue instead. And so they expedited a second appointment. Again, so they had to go back home, come back to Vanderbilt. So driving 10 hours out of their way, the patient's in abject pain just to get the care and the diagnosis that she needed. Now, we were able to take good care of her here, but the number of hoops that the couple had to go through just to access care is pretty maddening. And so we know that health disparities were more pronounced in lower income and in rural areas. And so this affects absolutely our catchment area and where we live.
I can't even think of words to say right now about that story, but how often do you see those microaggressions occurring within?
I have two great stories for you.
I can't. Yes, I need to hear these.
When I began my transition, I had been to my primary care physician in the town that I live in just prior. And during my appointment, this provider was carrying on and on and on about another patient who had a heart issue. I have heart issues. So he was carrying on and on and on about this other person. And I'm like, there is no way I am ever going to have a conversation about transitioning with this guy, because I'll tell you right now, everybody in the practice is going to know about it. There's no question in my mind. Well, that was one of my first introductions to Delray, because he helped me get a new primary care physician. And I've been seeing Dr. Taylor for several years now, and she's wonderful. The other story I was going to tell you is my brother had come into town. We were going to go to a football game in downtown Nashville one Sunday afternoon. And that morning I get up and I took my dogs for a walk. Well, the route we take is usually about 2 miles. About halfway through, I am getting this incredible pain in my back. Like I said, I've had heart issues in the past, so I'm immediately starting to think heart attack. And the pain was so excruciating, it brought me to my knees a couple of different times. And I kept debating to myself, should I call 911 now or should I wait till I get home? Because my wife is at home, my brother's sitting there. So I said, I'm going to tough it out and try to get home. So I get home and I call the ambulance. They come. They get me out into the truck. Now they have my ID that says Kelly Howski, has my correct gender on my ID. They get me out into the ambulance, and we start going to the ambulance, and the driver goes, oh, I got to stop over here and drop off my keys so somebody can move them. I'm like, what? So they stop, and I'm in pain. I'm writhing in agony in the back of this ambulance. So finally we leave there and we get to the hospital. They bring me into the ER. Now, I've been to this hospital previously. It wasn't Vanderbilt. Thank goodness. I had been to this hospital previously under my dead name. A dead name, for those that don't know, is the name that I previously used. They printed me up a tag to put on my wrist, and it had my wrong name and my wrong gender on it, even though I had given the ambulance people my ID. And they had asked for my ID at check-in. So they had the information and didn't put it in the system. I could care less at this point because I'm still in agony. They take me to get an MRI, an abdominal MRI, to find out what the pain could be from. And they bring me into the room. I'm in agony. The girl that brings me in helps me get on the table. I lay down. I'm doing the thing. And she leaves. And then there's just the x-ray tech there, who's a male. He comes over to me when he's done and he says, okay, get up. I'm like, I can't move. I'm in such pain. They didn't give me anything for pain. Okay, fine. He stands next to me and keeps saying to me, come on, get up, get up. You got to get up. You got to get up and crawl and get onto this gurney. I'm like, I don't friggin' believe this guy. I finally swing my legs over to sit on the edge of the bed, and then I start to stand up and fall on the floor. And he's standing there looking at me going, come on, come on, get up, get up, get up. I'm like, I can't believe this guy. Finally, somebody else comes in. They help me get me up and get me on the gurney and bring me in. Then they start finally giving me morphine. And a few minutes later, I find out, oh, you have this huge kidney stone. And you're in the process of passing it, which is what all the pain is from. But nobody up to that point had given me any indication that it wasn't a heart attack like I thought it was. Totally horrible experience. Once the pain was under control, I asked them about fixing my my record. And they said, well, we need your ID to do that. I said, okay, great. I gave them my ID. I get bills in the mail, follow-up stuff with my dead name still on it. They still hadn't updated the records. In order for me to update the records there, I had to go back again and give them my ID a third time. I was just unbelievable.
That's a terrible experience. And I can see where you'd be frustrated with the healthcare system, because some of those things are what I feel would be fairly simple things to take care of, which would explain some of the statistics that I'm about to go into that we've looked at. And as I was reading them, I was like, oh my goodness. But now it's starting to, I've got some context and I'm like, oh, okay, well, this explains a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So we went ahead and I looked at this recent survey that was conducted by the Center of the American Progress in 2020 in conjunction with a nonpartisan research group that found more than one in three LGBTQ Americans faced discrimination in some kind in the past year, including more than three in five transgender Americans, including one in two who report moderate or significant negative psychological impact due to discrimination, which really I think keys into that story you just told.
Mm-hmm.
Around 3 in 10 LGBTQ Americans faced difficulties last year accessing necessary medical care due to cost issues, including more than half of transgender Americans. 15% of LGBTQ Americans report postponing or avoiding medical treatment due to discrimination. And after that story, I can't even say, and the one you told, Delray, I can't even say I blame them, including nearly 3 in 10 transgender individuals. Transgender individuals faced unique obstacles to accessing healthcare, including 1 in 3 who had to teach their doctor about transgender individuals in order to receive appropriate care. And finally, LGBTQ Americans have experienced significant mental health issues related to the COVID-19 pandemic. So as we can see, this explains why this is a health disparate population. And now we recognize a little bit about that. And Delray, you had actually made a point earlier to talk about this happening, your story happening in a more rural setting. Do you notice that there are more disparities in some settings than in others, that in more maybe urban areas, this happens less? What do you notice as you look this over?
You know, I don't have data to back this up, but I would say that is fairly true. I think in urban areas, you're going to find more resources generally that are available to the LGBTQ community. I think that's where you're going to find more affirming providers overall. Not to say that they're not affirming providers in rural areas, but I think that that the concentration and at least the knowledge of where to turn to, you're going to find that information in more urban settings. One thing in particular that I wanted to mention is around mental health disparities.
Mm-hmm.
One thing we always say in our trainings is that there's nothing endemically wrong with LGBTQ people, but we see very specific mental health concerns from suicidality, anxiety and depression, substance abuse, you know, the list goes on. And all of those things are coping mechanisms from the stress that we experience from being sexual and gender minorities. So I think it plays out in very, very, very profound ways and certainly exacerbates cost for healthcare. If someone doesn't have a foundation in mental health, what we know about minority stress theory is that after experiencing a lot of microaggressions day in and day out, the body over time starts to release more cortisol. Too much cortisol in the bloodstream creates a whole host of metabolic issues. So mental health concerns later on will become physical health concern. And so the other thing I want to mention is what you said around trans people having to teach providers how to take care of them. The truth is that medical providers have not historically been taught about the tenets of LGBTQ healthcare, certainly not gender-affirming care, in medical schools or in nursing schools. And that's something that we're moving the needle on. As a matter of fact, our program was founded in 2012 from a call from medical students who said, we're not getting the information we need to be able to take care of sexual and gender minority patients. Can you help? And so Dr. Jesse Ehrenfeld, our founding director, heard that call and instituted the program specifically to begin to build out curricular elements. So today, we actually have a certificate program in the School of Medicine so that folks can actually gain a certificate in LGBTQ healthcare in addition to receiving their medical diploma. We do lots of lecturing in Vanderbilt School of Nursing, Belmont School of Nursing here locally, and get invited to speak to other organizations as well. So the time is ripe to increase education on these topics. Also, the specialty of hormone therapy has historically lived in endocrinology. What's happening now is that's actually moving more into the primary care space. And we want to teach more providers the ins and outs of provision of hormone therapy to make those services more accessible and easier for trans folks to be able to access.
I think that's great. And I was saying, so in my nurse practitioner program, we maybe had a few slides on LGBTQ. And I think the appropriate thing for a provider to do rather than, hey, teach me about, you know, transgender to your patient, is to seek out these resources and to seek out these evidence-based resources so that they can teach themselves, knowing that this is a population, again, that has disparities, mm-hmm. and that you will be serving this population at some point in time. Would you say that's the appropriate thing for a practitioner to do, is to go out and seek these resources so that they can provide that particular care to their patients?
Absolutely. And while most practices will see transgender patients, not every practice is set up to provide gender-affirming care. There's not an expectation there at all, but how welcoming would any clinic be to trans patients? Kelly gave a perfect example of a healthcare organization using her dead name and keeping that information on file. We've actually been in a process here at Vanderbilt Medical Center to engage in a process that would allow us to transform our electronic health records to better document sexual orientation and gender identity data. And so the issue that Kelly ran into is that these EHRs are legally binding and are very difficult to change. And so we need to have different kinds of fields that are more patient-centered and ultimately provide better patient-centered care. So we're moving to a process that where we will have the ability to capture every patient's legal name and additionally the names that they use. We will capture every patient's sex assigned at birth, which will remain a static field. We will also capture legal sex, so what's on your driver's license. And that's relatively static unless somebody presents a new ID that has, where someone has gone through that gender marker change. Additionally, patients will have the ability to tell us who they are and to state their own gender identity. So that'll be a field that can be toggled in a patient-facing portal, as well as it can be changed by our clinical staff during an interaction if someone is on a journey to discover more about themselves and who they are and what gender they identify with. And so we've been asking for this for 4 years. It's just now getting operationalized. And the mechanics of it, once you start looking under the hood of these data systems, well, there are a lot of downstream effects. Kelly mentioned mailing and billing. And we have to have systems that talk to insurance, systems that talk to clinical staff, systems that talk to labs. And so we have to make sure that we sync all these new data fields with the downstream users as well, so that we can be congruent and comprehensive in our approach. And also, we have to protect our patients' privacy as well. Some people may be out to their clinical provider, but not out at home. So how are we sending mail to the home? Are we protecting that patient's identity if they're not yet out? So those are a lot of considerations. And so this process is taking a really, really long time.
But how can we do an organizational assessment as it relates to LGBTQ disparities or care?
That's a really great question. And I'll tell you, the Human Rights Campaign has probably the best assessment tool I can think of. HRC sponsors the annual, I think it's biannual now, Healthcare Equality Index, or the HEI. And this is a really lengthy survey which allows organizations to do a really rich self-assessment. And we then provide documentation to Human Rights Campaign, who will vet all these organizations based on these survey results and measure us to tell us how we're doing. Now, I'm really proud to say that Vanderbilt has scored 100% and are seen as a leader in this survey. I think we're going on a decade now. For several years, we have been the only organization in Tennessee to score 100% on the HEI. And this past year, our past couple of years, rather, we've been joined by our friends at the Veterans Administration, who are really close by. So that's been really exciting. But I think any healthcare organization can participate in this survey, and I think it's a wonderful tool. They change the survey every year and are always adding questions and considering pushing the bounds on potential policies and practices. And so every year there's new opportunity to grow and consider the needs of respective organizations to do a better job.
Wow. Well, first of all, congratulations to your team at Vanderbilt. That's incredibly exciting. And kudos to each and every one of you and your team members for making such an impact. And secondly, I did not know that there was a tool such as this around. And what a great opportunity for our healthcare colleagues to be a part of a collaborative and multidisciplinary effort to ensure that their organization conducts a thorough assessment and does so with the right resources at hand. This also would provide a great opportunity for NPD practitioners and nurse educators to conduct environmental scanning to identify opportunities as well. And one way that we as NPD practitioners could do this is to identify the key access points of care for this disparate population. And this could in turn support some organizational prioritization. Kelly, could you shed some light on common patient access points for the transgender patient population?
Sure. My path is very different from others. But when I decided to transition, I had no idea where to begin, what that process would look like. There's no roadmap out there, right? And everybody's transition, everybody's experience is different. I reached out to Del Rey and asked him about an endocrinologist because I knew at least that much. You know, the Google is a great resource for some things, and at least I got that much education. And so he was able to refer me to a provider at Vanderbilt, and that was a great relationship. From there, it goes to really, in my estimation, the whole mental health arena, because there are so many aspects of transition that people need to be prepared for. And if they don't have a good mental health practitioner to help guide them through the process, then you really end up in trouble. You know, there was a recent 60 Minutes episode where they talked about the transgender community and a lot of the negative legislation that many states were promoting this past year. And then they veered and they went and spent a pretty incredible amount of time on how many people transitioned and then changed their mind. It was like, oh my goodness, this isn't for me. I need to go. Or they wanted to reverse the transition. And as I watched that, I was acutely aware of the fact that most of those people, and at least the people that they interviewed, were very young people. So, you know, recently of age where they could make decisions on their own, and they didn't have great access or didn't have great guidance for mental health practitioners. They went in, somebody checked the box, wrote them a letter, and sent them on their way. There were no in-depth conversations over a period of time. I'm a little bit older, so I knew what I was getting into. But for somebody who's young and doesn't have a lot of life experience, then I think in those cases, you really need to take more time and have more in-depth conversations about the impact of what you're doing. Some of these folks even went through the point of having surgery with little or no real counseling and even being on hormones for a short period of time. That all in and of itself set up all kinds of red flags for me. WPATH kind of writes the standards for transgender healthcare. And WPATH has been around for a long time and they've been doing some really great, incredible things. And one of the first rules, if you will, it's not a rule, it's a policy and a recommendation is that when you're starting hormones, you stay on hormones for at least 12 months before you go any farther. And most of the people in this 60 Minutes piece didn't, they were on hormones for 4 months, 5 months, 6 months, and didn't really even produce or continue down that path. So there's great standards out there. I know the folks at Vanderbilt pay attention to that. I know that my mental health practitioner pays attention to those things. And we had in-depth conversations before the process of, for me actually, to have surgery and move in that direction as well. So that's a really important miss that people have. From there you go to, okay, what's next? Well, it depends, you know, male to female, female to male. Some people choose surgery and surgical options. And a lot of folks are trying to pass. In other words, they want to appear as if. And so many of their next steps are more cosmetic than they are otherwise. And that's when you start to have facial surgery or neck surgery or breast augmentation or removal of breasts. And again, you have to get to that point, right? You can't just say, oh, I'm going to transition and call a surgeon at Vanderbilt and have surgery next week. It doesn't work that way. And it shouldn't, honestly. There's a lot of considerations that have to come into play. And then beyond that, it's the routine stuff, right? So I'm a trans woman. Okay, great. I've had surgery. Awesome. but there are still parts of my body that are male and not female. And so my healthcare practitioner needs to be aware of that and understand those differences and be able to treat me long-term accordingly. And those are important considerations that a lot of people don't recognize.
If I can add a couple of points there too, and thank you, Kelly, for just such a great description of different kinds of access points. What I think about is the first encounters that people make. So when people come to Vanderbilt, depending on how they roll up, might be greeted in valet, and so how are valet staff treating our trans patients, right? And when patients check in for appointments, if you've got a busy staff person at a front desk who is used to asking very specific questions related to sex assigned at birth, and you're not checking IDs benchmarked against electronic health records, when trans folks check into appointments, are they getting dead named? Are they getting misgendered? Right. We've actually created a whole program called Trans Buddy to help mitigate some of those hiccups that happen. Our Trans Buddy program actually predates our clinic for trans health because we were seeing more and more trans patients here recognizing these issues were happening. And so we created a volunteer program. So we have 30 trained volunteers in the medical center who will accompany a trans patient to any kind of healthcare visit, whether it's a scheduled clinic visit, inpatient stay, emergency room, extended psychiatric hospital stay. And the benefit there is if something goes south, if an interaction doesn't go well, our volunteers are there to provide gentle real-time education to help mitigate the issue at hand. So the onus never on the patient themselves, who they are, and to bear the brunt of potential microaggressions that might occur. So that's really been a wonderful program and a way to help with some of those more sore access points.
Just from the mental health support that's needed. And that leads me back, and I'm in my head like, well, no wonder why this is a bigger issue in rural areas, because you have less access to things like that mm-hmm. in rural areas and the things that you need. And I'm like, oh, how do we fix all of this? Oh my goodness. But the honest answer is NPD practitioners, we only have so much power within our scope, but we do like to look at what it is that we can affect change in. And just kind of where we can play a role in helping these healthcare professionals with the necessary training to ensure that inclusivity within the LGBTQ population, like teaching LGBTQ competencies, such as discussing ways to avoid unconscious bias or using gender inclusive language and identifying LGBTQ specific disparities and how that can provide a better experience for the population. So Kelly, I'd like to ask you what advice you would like to give to nurse educators who are responsible for that interprofessional staff education, because it has to happen with just more than just doctors and more than just nurses, as Delroy was pointing out, it's the whole organization who are looking to develop that training to promote inclusivity and gender inclusive competence.
First, I'll say that in working in conjunction with Del Rey and other people on our board, we've had some very meaningful and I think helpful interactions with some of the nursing schools in the area and in providing a program to have very open and honest and frank conversations with people so that they have a better glimpse of the LGBTQ community overall. The other thing is, and I don't know about y'all, but I love Brené Brown, and I just think the world of her. I'm seeing you nod your head, Jim. Yeah. Jim. But she tells a story about a speech that she gave at an event in Texas, and she's backstage and she's getting ready for the speech, and she peeks out and looks at the audience, and it's all of these people in like Brooks Brothers suits, and it's all men, right? And she starts to freak out because she's never spoken to a group like that of that level of professional. And she's like, they told me sea level people. I thought it was C-S-E-A, you know, salt of the earth kind of everyday folk, right? And here the sea level is, no, it's CFOs and COOs and CEOs. And she's like, she's talking about vulnerability and shame and you know, how are these people going to relate to this? And it's not her typical audience. And so she's skimming through Google looking for all these terms that she wants to use and interject into her talk so that she sounds more professional. And her husband makes her promise not to. That's it. No, Brene, there's no way you could do that. Don't do that. And she says, okay. But somebody in the audience came back to the green room to wish her luck. And it was a woman that she knew and knew fairly well. And what she realized, and this lady was a managing partner at a law firm, and what she realized was that, you know what, they're people. They're just like this lady who, although she's a managing partner in a very prestigious law firm, she's a mom and she has kids and she's going through a really messy divorce. And that's just part of life. And then she notices a guy in the audience who is a little bit older. And she was like, you know what? I used to be in AA with him when I was in college, way back when, right? And so what she realized and what she said to herself was people, people, people. They're people. They're just like you and I. And that speech ended up being a massive success. And they cried together. They laughed together. And at the end of the day, it was perfect. It was great. And Brene, of course, was her typical self. But my comment and the reason I tell that story is I managed a client experience team for a number of years for a global automotive company. And one of the things we taught people was we have to make connection with people. You know, we serve our clients well. We do that first by making connection and listening. And then by helping them solve whatever issue it is that they're contacting us for. And I think in the healthcare space in particular, that's a really important message to make sure everybody gets. They're a person. They're just like you. They're just like me. They have families. They have kids. They have, you know, the same kind of concerns about their healthcare. And the other thing is, we're coming to you and putting our trust in you as a healthcare provider to take care of us. That's a huge deal, right? Whether we're transgender or not, we're putting our trust in you. And our expectation is that you're going to treat us with dignity and respect and solve whatever health issue we have, or if it's just maintenance, do that. The education is super, super important. You know, just being aware. Having conversations like this with people about what it means to be transgender and what the differences are, even though the body parts may be a little bit different, at the end of the day, you're still a human being. You still need adequate care. And I think if we focus on relationship, then a lot of the other stuff just kind of falls away. I can make a mistake, and if you know me and I say, oh, you know what, Jen, would you forgive me for that? What are you going to say? No. Chances are you're going to say, of course, Kelly, no problem. But if we don't take time to build relationship and to own our mistakes, and we're all going to make them, we do every day, every one of us do. We're not perfect. But when we own those mistakes and we focus on the relationship, then everything else just comes along so much easier.
Kelly, you really hit that home. And I don't have much to add there, although I want to say how this dovetails with some of our unconscious bias training that we do here in the medical center. And Jen specifically mentioned unconscious bias. And when I think about health disparities more broadly, whether it's racial and ethnic health disparities based on weight or based on gender or sexual orientation or any of the things that define us. What I do know about bias is that everybody has it. I have it, you have it, we all have it. And bias is actually a natural function of life. Bias, a lot of people will equate with prejudice and discrimination. However, bias really relates to the associations that we make in our minds based on past experiences. Bias is really a shortcut in how we see the world. So if I encounter something new, I'm going to pull out of my own file folder in my head my past experience with something that reminds me of this new experience, and I'm going to react based on how I reacted in my past. So perfect example of bias is a young person touches a hot stove. Next time they encounter any kind of stove, they realize, oh, I need to check that first. So bias in of itself is actually there to keep us safe. Nobody, we don't want to rid ourselves of bias. What we want to do is to understand what bias actually is. And then there are tried and true steps that we can take to overcome bias. And the number one step, I think, is to lean in and seek out leaders and communities of people that you might identify bias within yourself. Go reach out to those communities, build relationships, exactly what you're saying, that is the only tried and true way to overcome bias. And I certainly can tell this on myself. I'm 48 years old. And when I came out as a gay man at age 19, I was very concerned about my own safety. I went to school at University of Tennessee in Knoxville at a time when I did not feel safe to be gay. And interestingly enough, at that time, we didn't have a full understanding of gender identity. And the word transgender was not in the lexicon at the time. But I can tell you that I had strong bias against people who might have been considered to be transgender at the time, because I was so concerned with my own safety that, to me, I felt the need to butch it up, be hyper masculine. And I was concerned about myself that I didn't want to associate with anybody else that I thought might put me at risk in any kind of way. And so I closed myself to a lot of people in my own community when I was young. And that makes me heartsick to think about today. And the only thing that has made a difference is the ability to work alongside with people who I consider different from how I show up in the world, and to get to know more about their experiences and gender empathy. And now I'm so fortunate that I have friendships with lots of different kinds of people, and absolutely count transgender people as some of my best friends who I seek out, because oftentimes the way trans people see the world is so well-rounded from seeing life from so many different perspectives, and having to endure the hardship associated with just gaining access to healthcare resources and all the things that people have to navigate that makes us stronger, right? And so over time, I know the value of personal relationships has changed my own bias. It's the only way. Kelly, you really hit that home, and I just wanted to underscore that, because we talk so much about unconscious bias in healthcare, and that when we recognize we have bias, we absolutely have to forge relationships with the people that we have some fear around. We need to get to know them and dispel that fear.
Yeah, I agree, Delray. Excellent.
So as we look to next steps to develop resources or to develop content, what type of evidence-based resources exist that we can tap into? Delray, I know you shed some light on the organizational assessment, but what other evidence-based resources would you recommend to inform inclusive, competent care?
Sure. A couple of textbooks immediately come to mind. The first is lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender healthcare, which was edited by Dr. Kristen Ekstrand and Dr. Jesse Ehrenfeld. And that that textbook is published by Springer, available for purchase online. A lot of medical libraries will have access to this. I just think it is an incredible medical textbook. It's the second medical textbook on LGBTQ healthcare, widely used across the U.S. And Dr. Ehrenfeld and Dr. Ekstrand actually co-founded our program. So I think that's a wonderful resource. Would also like to point to another clinical textbook called The Fenway Guide to Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, and Transgender Health. The Fenway Institute in Boston is the oldest LGBTQ healthcare organization. I believe they're celebrating 50 years, and they've published the first textbook on LGBTQ healthcare. So I think they have wonderful resources. I would also point to their website, the Fenway Institute's website. They have lots of online learning. Those modules are easy to access and chock full of information. They have a number of trainings available that I would highly recommend.
So, wow, those are some really great resources, and I think that they'll be very helpful. And as we talked about earlier, every organization is on their own journey to identify how they can promote inclusive care for disparate health populations. Some are farther along than others, but we are, again, as NPD practitioners or educators, very uniquely, I think, positioned to participate on things like committees and stakeholder councils to help prioritize action steps towards gender inclusive, competent care. We always like to, in our podcasts, talk about NPD implications for the topic that we're talking about. And I think one of those is to ensure that our staff has, again, that knowledge to care for an underserved patient population, because lacking that knowledge, we might overlook some life-threatening health risks. And I do believe that nurses in particular want to do the best they can for all of their patients. But that involves getting to know the intricacies of your patient population. And that's where NPD practitioners, I think, can step in. So listeners, if you are interested in learning more about NPD practitioners fulfilling an integral role in promoting inclusive care, there are a number of sessions within our diversity and inclusion track during AMPD's 2021 annual convention, Aspire to Inclusivity. And these sessions will do a deep dive into the NPD practitioner's role in ensuring diversity and inclusion for this population. This year's convention will take place online August 3rd through 6th, so it will be accessible to everyone. Now, Delray and Kelly, this has just been wonderful speaking to you today, and so informative and helpful. Do you guys have any last thoughts as we close out our podcast today?
I think for me, I just want to say thank you. Thank you for paying attention. Thank you for promoting diversity in healthcare. These are the kind of steps that change people's future and change people's lives. And the fact that you're willing to invest that time and energy and do that is very meaningful to me. Thank you.
Thank you. Indeed. Thank you very much for hosting us today. And you know, as Kelly is the chairwoman for our program's community advisory board, that's something that I'm really left with is the idea, and you just mentioned this, Jen, about engaging stakeholders. You know, that's something that we have been intentional about in shaping our program, as well as shaping our clinical services. 3 years ago, we reached out and created a community advisory board of 15 people who are heavily engaged in the idea of making available new and comprehensive healthcare resources for LGBTQ patients And certainly this is, this is another way I've gotten to know Kelly over the past few years, and Kelly sharing her wisdom today gives you insight in who she is and how she has really helped us see through a different lens, through her own lens, to help shape what we are doing in clinical spaces. Kelly has certainly weighed in on a variety of topics, including the transformation of our electronic healthcare record system over time and looking at the advancement of our clinical services. So I think being sure on patient and family advisory councils more broadly to really be considerate of the inclusion of LGBT people on your patient and family advisory boards. Not everybody has the luxury to have a community advisory board just full of LGBTQ people, but certainly casting a net and being mindful of being inclusive of the voices will go a long way in helping to transform your organization.
Well, Delray, Kelly, thank you both so much for joining Jen and I today. Listeners, if you are interested in learning more, not only do we encourage you to join us at our 2021 annual convention, Aspire to Inclusivity, we encourage you to join us at an upcoming webinar on the topic of unconscious bias in education design. We will also be sure to include a number of references and resources that were mentioned during our conversation today. Those will be posted in the podcast discussion forum, available at www.anpd.org. You can access the discussion forum through the Tools and Resources tab, and you will see this episode's topic, LGBTQ Health Disparities in Transgender Care. Be sure to post your questions or comments, and don't forget, you can listen to our podcast series by subscribing to the NPD Forecast on the ANPD website, podcast page, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and iHeartRadio.
This NPD Forecast series analyzes information gathered through environmental scanning. Our goal at ANPD is to be your leading resource for NPD practice. If you like what you hear, please leave a 5-star rating on your preferred podcast platform, as well as a review. And if you feel so inclined, share with your friends and colleagues on social media. Be sure to tag ANPD when you do. Those ratings and reviews help us grow this platform and extend our reach. As NPD practitioners, we know our strength is in our sense of community. So the more you share the NPD Forecast, the more valuable this environmental scanning resource will be. We would love to hear from you and encourage you to post podcast topic recommendations in the podcast discussion forum available on our website.
Thanks for listening. For more information, visit our website at anpd.org.